Our program today, if you drop back, or look back over the last two decades, there was a time in the 90s where there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for Japan's engagement with Central Asia. And Japan was very active and visibly so. It focused on especially on emergency relief. Really very effectively. And also involved in a lot of other cultural areas in a very, I think, very productive manner. At the same time, the Asian, the successful Asian economies attracted tremendous interest within Central Asia. There were young students being sent off to all the Asian tigers, and coming back full of very exciting stories about what they'd seen and learned. And Korea, of course, was very central in that phase as well. So both Japan and Korea, I think, created a certain kind of levels of expectation back then. Our purpose today is to ask, well, what's going on today? And I think we'll hear that there is both more and less than we might think, but we want to address this both from the side of Japan and Korea, but also from the side of Central Asians, who, after all, including Afghanistan, have the concept of a balanced foreign policy. You use A to balance B and C to balance A and B and so forth. The question is there any sense in which Japan and Korea can figure in that balance within the region? If so, well, how? If not, why not? We're really lucky to have very good people, experts to speak to this. We're going to begin with Dr. William Brooks, who's been an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins since 2009. He was in the State Department prior to that. For 15 years, he served as head of the U.S. Embassy in Japan Media Analysis and Translation Unit, which made him responsible for analyzing the impact of Japanese media trends on U.S. interests. He has a doctorate from Columbia and has taught history at the university level before entering the government, and he is the author of a number of monographs that are very relevant, including Politics and Trade Policy in Japan, which just came out this year. He's writing people on Japanese politics. Then we're going to hear from Dr. Babina Kwan, who is currently a visiting professor at American University. She was, for several years, a senior special advisor to Ambassador Christopher Hill, Assistant Secretary for East Asian Pacific Affairs in the State Department. And in 2009-10, she taught at courses on Northeast Asian security at the National Defense University. She earned her PhD in government from Georgetown, and MA from Columbia, and before that was an undergraduate at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Then, finally, we will hear from Stephen Blank, whom you all know, I'm sure, is a person with very long-term interest and commitment to the study and analysis of security issues in this entire region. He is the author of a whole pile of important articles and book on China, on Russia-China relations, and he has always calculated Central Asia into this picture. I think that's a product of his having studied initially at the University of Chicago in the years when it was undoubtedly the greatest center for the study of that part of the world. So, we are fortunate to have all three of you, and we'll start with Dr. Brooks.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your introduction.
We've just had an invasion of Rumsfeld.
I appreciate this time. Last time I gave a talk here, the slides that I brought couldn't be seen from the podium. So I went through the entire presentation looking over my shoulder to try to figure out where I was. But this time I can see them. To do this topic, Japan's role in Central Asia, I actually had to do a lot more digging than I wanted to do. Usually, when I start a project, I can find information everywhere, and it's a matter of trying to sort out what I want to use. This time, I had to really dig. I went, for example, to a standard diplomatic history of Japan, which ends in 2003, and there were two pages on Central Asia. I went to the Foreign Ministry's Blue Book, which is online, and found almost nothing but a few speeches and a few visitors and things like that. So the narrative about Japan's policy towards Central Asia really, except for maybe a couple of monographs, a couple of old books, really doesn't exist. So I'm sort of starting from scratch.
One of them was published by the Central Asia Conference Institute.
Excellent.
Years back.
Yes, there were a lot of books that were about 10 years old. Since I'm trying to focus today on the Abe administration, I found it extremely frustrating that even though he is going to the five Central Asian countries next week, there hasn't been a word in the press about it, no announcement. At any rate, let's begin the show, and I am going to use these slides to take you here and there, and finally you'll get to where we want to go. Let's see. Yeah, okay. To get started, I'd like to take a look at the diplomacy of Japan towards the region before Prime Minister Abe. Because based on Abe's track record so far as an activist, proactive prime minister, things are likely to happen during his visit that we may not expect. For the most part, though, the post-war period of Japan's relations with Central Asia were fairly quiet. The main foreign policy, these are just basic foreign policy elements, were to manage an alliance with the United States. During the Cold War, managing an alliance with the United States for Japan meant doing nothing but paying for the maintenance of troops. Just keep out of the way of big power rivalries. Japan's real test became evident after the Cold War and in Central Asia when Japan had to do something more than just maintain a status quo and found itself trying to cope with the changing international environment. The second element was making the United Nations the other pillar of Japan's foreign policy. And how did the Central Asian countries figure into that? Well, Japan indeed wants to have a seat, a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. So for years, it has been courting countries around the world in order to get support for that end. And the third element of its policy is to develop markets for export of Japanese goods and ensuring supplies of energy and other natural resources. And a lot of that element of its general foreign policy has been focused, obviously, on Central Asia, as well as the rest of Asia. Pursuing friendly ties with all countries. And even though, in some cases, the United States, its allies, might not be happy with that. For example, Japan, for 50 years, has had a pretty good relationship with Cuba. When I served in the embassy, we used to try to stop Japan from doing things with Cuba in the United Nations context. They even invited Castro over a couple of times. So Japan may have been an ally of the United States, but it does have a tradition of doing things independently on its own, which may not exactly fly. I'll get to another example of that a little bit later. And of course, the pillar of Japan's foreign policy has always been its official development assistance, with a strong emphasis on Asia. For many years, the Japanese aid was considered tied to Japanese companies. The quality of the aid has improved tremendously, and all the grant element, all of the terms have become extremely good. Japan is not number one anymore in the world as an aid donor, but it's one of the most important aid donors for not only infrastructure, but also for the human security, basic human needs, etc. And then the diplomatic framework basically has remained in place since at least the 1980s, 1990s. But after the Cold War, Japan, including in its ODA, has begun to add a strategic element. Whether that strategic element is for its own national interests, or for the international community's interests, or even for the interests of the United States, there has been a strategic part in its ODA. So ODA given to a country may not have on the surface of it conditions, but there is something behind it. Let me give you an example. In 1979, Japan began a huge yen loan program with China, supporting China's modernization. And that continued for at least two decades. It wasn't just to promote export markets or even import. It was to ensure the stability and the longevity of a moderate government in China. And the U.S. was complicit in this. We were happy that China was being, China's modernization under Deng Xiaoping was being supported by Japan, because we wanted to keep China in the international community. Even after the Tiananmen incident in 1989, it was Japan that brokered China's re-entry into the international community about a year later, with the okay of other countries like the United States. That example shows that Japan indeed does have a strategy that sometimes is not evident, but is definitely there. Prime Minister Abe, and if anybody is a strategic thinker, he is. Japan now has its own national strategy, first ever, and National Security Council, first ever, and a lot of plans in the region, particularly in the region, for its future. So Abe's goal, strengthen U.S. ties. His goal has also been successful with a set of new defense guidelines, U.S.-Japan defense cooperation guidelines, and he has signed a TPP deal. The TPP agreement with the United States and Japan, as well as the other 10 countries, is extremely significant for Abe, because now the U.S. and Japan have a free trade agreement, and if extended beyond trade, Japan has the okay now, as an FTA agreement with the United States, to import shale gas as LNG. So, under the Abe government, Japan has its policy agenda, a national strategy, and a leadership to implement them. And the a willingness to meet its security challenges, including use of collective self-defense. For the first time in Japan's history, Japan has a new formula so that in case, for example, the United States and Japan are in conflict, Japan could come to the aid of the United States and not just fold its hands and watch the United States get beaten up. So this aspect of Japan's alliance with the U.S., of being able to actually support each other, is a new perspective. On a global perspective, Abe has initiated a proactive diplomacy that has extended in around the globe. He has visited at least 50 countries already. So next week, when he goes to the five countries of Central Asia, that number will rise to 55. Is he just going to Central Asia to add that check off that box? I don't know. Is he going to Central Asia to initiate a new Abe initiative, a new doctrine? Maybe. We'll have to wait and see. But I can guess a little bit on that a little bit later. Most of the Abe doctrine, Abe's foreign policy, targets Southeast Asia. And in 2014, he gave a long speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue, Asia Security Summit. And in this, he extended support for ASEAN's efforts to counter China's maritime advances in the South China Sea. This was an earth-shaking development. For Japan to actually get involved in a strategic move in Southeast Asia to try to help the countries there, like the Philippines and South Vietnam, counter the maritime aggression or advances of China, was something which nobody anticipated. The corollary of that is strategic relationships are being built not only with Southeast Asia, but also with Australia and India. Will there be strategic relations with Central Asian countries in the future? Maybe. If Abe is around long enough, that is conceivable. Whether the Central Asian countries are willing to talk in those terms is another story. The main points of the Abe Doctrine: future-oriented approach with an emphasis on global contributions and the responses. Even the U.S.-Japan alliance has taken on a global proportion and is not just limited to the region. Support for ASEAN security mechanisms. Rejection of attempts to change the status quo in the region, the Asia-Pacific region, by force. And this is, of course, intended towards China. What about China? Thrust is aimed at China's maritime advances. Japan, under Abe, also wants to improve ties with that country under the rubric of a mutually beneficial strategic relationship. Let me explain that. Japan has a hedging policy towards China. On the one hand, strengthening the alliance and having these strategic relationships in Southeast Asia are to stop the maritime advances. But Japan has a huge economic stake in China, as well as a political stake in the region. So there is an attempt to build up, rebuild relationships that were soured over a territorial dispute recently. So to get back to a normal relationship again, it's a slow fall, but it's happening. So the strategic ties are already underway, making progress a little bit with even India. Perhaps Abe is a little more enthusiastic than India is, but a strategic relationship, including perhaps the United States as a triangular relationship, is in the works. And then, of course, the driving force of all of this is Japan's rivalry with China. My thesis is that the two powers have enormous rivalry for influencing Asian countries. And the Central Asian countries are up for grabs, according to Japan. Japan would like to extend its influence to the Central Asian regions and push back perhaps a little bit of China's influence, push back a little bit of Russia's influence. And how it will do that, we'll see. So he has this values diplomacy, Abe's values diplomacy, which is designed to encircle, even isolate China and Asia. And as you can see from that map, the map is in Japanese, but it does delineate all of the countries I mentioned, the Southeast Asian countries included. And then, of course, this is a map, of the claim to the South China Sea, which now Japan is side by side with the U.S. There was even talk about Japan sending its patrol ships into the region to try to keep the waters open. I don't think that's going to happen. But certainly with the Philippines, it has mutual drills. It has provided certain kinds of equipment to the Philippines, patrol ships, etc. And the same talk is going on with Vietnam. And then, of course, in the East China Sea, Japan has its own territorial dispute with China. But the real issue is not the territory itself, some rocks called Senkakus. If you take a look at this slide, the area is just full of natural resources, gas fields that both countries in 2008 agreed to jointly develop. That's been put in on hold, but eventually that enormous potential for gas exploration, there'll have to be a decision made between Japan and China as to how to go about it, or whether to fight over it. There's the Senkakus right there, and as you can see from this slide picture on the bottom, there are skirmishes sometimes of Chinese vessels and Japanese Coast Guard vessels. It is conceivable that an incident could occur at any time. And one final strategic point, Okinawa itself, if you take a look at the map, is an incredibly geostrategic, geopolitically important area for Japan. And much of Japan's policy, defense policy focus is now on building up the region. For example, here is a map which shows the capability of Japan defending Okinawa and the remote islands around Okinawa during a contingency. And this is a very... Let me run ahead. What's wrong with the following map? There isn't any Central Asia on it. Despite the dearth of information, there's been a steadily ratcheting up of the region's importance in Japan's diplomacy since the 1990s. A gradual awareness of Central Asia. We can see that in the early attempts in the 1990s to engage Central Asia. Prime Minister Hashimoto embarked on Silk Road diplomacy in 1997. And then Prime Minister Koizumi embarked on the Central Asia plus Japan, CA plus Japan initiative that remains in place under Abe. I'll skip this and get on to Mr. Abe. So, Japan under Abe is again focusing on Central Asia. Prime Minister Abe is ratcheting up the diplomatic ties with those countries. He'll visit all five countries next week, October 22-25, the first by a Japanese Prime Minister since 2006. But it's also a part of the strategy to contain or counter China's influence in the region, and that has now surpassed that of Russia. Japan has a two-pronged Eurasian strategy. An important one is that Japan, now engaged in a global scale power rivalry with China, wants to prevent the One Belt, One Road project that monopolizes control over Central Asia's warm water ports. And this appears over and over again. His first stop, Kazakhstan. Here he is meeting with the president. The interest in Kazakhstan is the export of nuclear plants, technology and equipment, diversifying its sources for rare earth minerals after China cut it off in 2010. So Kazakhstan has become an important source of rare earth minerals. Next stop would be Kyrgyzstan. Again, exploration and protection of mineral resources, energy, transport, communication, agriculture, processing, industry, training of specialists, tourism, social and financial school sectors. An incredible catalog of issues. And of course, all this is pinned on ODA. So ODA has continued to work for wonders in the region. In Tajikistan, focuses on economic issues, but there's also a regional security aspect as well. Turkmenistan, again, a huge amount of activity, $1.7 billion deal to build an LNG production plant, and again, an another target for Japan's need to diversify its energy markets and find more and more ports. And Uzbekistan, the last stop for Abe, remained focus there, again, the ODA and the aspect of more infrastructure and more investments in that country's economy. So, summary, to compensate for the loss of the nuclear power following the Fukushima accident, Japan has sped up its technological investment in Central Asian energy markets. It needs to find the fuels and precious metals that Japan needs more than ever. And then second, under the Abe administration, Japan wants to prevent China with its own Silk Road projects, trying to balance, and just as it's doing in Myanmar, trying to balance and counter China's influence. That's it.
Thank you very much.